This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, two novels. Celeste Ng, on her Amazon Book of the Year winning debut, Everything I Never Told You, and then Ben Okri, on his long-awaited novel, The Age of Magic. Celeste Ng grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Shaker Heights, Ohio, in a family of scientists. Her fiction and essays have appeared in One Story, Bellevue Literary Review, and elsewhere, and she is a recipient of the Pushcart Prize. Her debut novel, which has just been named an Amazon Book of the Year, is Everything I Never Told You. So, Celeste, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'll ask you, first of all, to describe what the book is about.
It takes place in the 1970s, and it focuses on a mixed-race family. The father is a Chinese-American, and the mother is a white-American. They have three children. And at the beginning of the novel, their favorite daughter, Lydia, who is 16, disappears and is found drowned in the local lake. And this causes the family to confront a lot of sort of painful secrets that they've been hiding for a long time.
And that's literally not giving anything away. There's no spoiler there. Literally the first line of the book is Lydia is dead.
Yes.
We know right from the beginning.
Right. No spoilers in what I just said.
It does take the family a couple of chapters to discover that, but the reader knows right from the beginning. But were you ever tempted, in the writing of the novel, were you ever tempted to make it a more of a mystery for the audience as well?
Actually, yes. In earlier drafts of the novel, up until the very last draft of the novel, the reader was a little bit in the dark about that as well. The novel used to begin a bit differently. It used to say, at first, they don't know where Lydia has gone. And neither the reader nor the family found out that Lydia had died until maybe 40, 50 pages in. And as I worked on revising the novel, I started to realize that that information needed to be upfront, at least for the reader. The reader needed to sort of know what was going on and be able to see a little bit farther than the family could.
So let's talk about that family then. So if we can, we'll go through the various family members. James, the father, as you just said, James is a Chinese American. He's a second generation. His parents are first generation Chinese immigrants. James is, he wants to fit in, doesn't he? His main preoccupation in life is fitting in.
Yes, I think that's a very good assessment of him. So his parents were immigrants. He was born in America, but he's, I think, always very conscious of his status as an Asian man, a Chinese-American man, in an area where there aren't very many other Asians. In the small town that this family lives in, they're the only Asian family in the community. And I think that James really feels that very intensely, and that sort of motivates a lot of what he does. He's a professor of American history at the university, and that in some ways is, he's actually got a specialty in cowboys. He teaches a class on cowboys. It's a way of sort of finding a connection to America and being an expert in it. And his expectations for his daughter as well are that she fit in. He really wants her to fit in and sort of be socially accepted and be accepted into the community in a way that he feels he never has been.
So you're talking about what he wants from Lydia, and what he wants from Lydia most of all is that she will fit in, but more than that, she will be popular. She will become, I guess she will become more American.
Right. And there's a sort of wish fulfillment there, I think, because that was something that never happened for him. And he really wants that for Lydia. He really wants her to have lots of friends and to be very popular and to be very social in a way that he wasn't and isn't even as an adult.
And Marilyn, his wife, Lydia's mother, she's not Chinese. She's white American. And she also has projections that she puts onto Lydia, expectations of her own.
Right, very different ones though, but a similar feeling maybe to James, or similar rationale. Marilyn had always wanted to go into medicine and to become a doctor. That was sort of her childhood dream. Her own mother was a high school home economics teacher, so teaching cooking and sewing and all that sort of stuff. And Marilyn, growing up in Virginia, had really wanted to do something different than what she saw her mother doing and wanted to go into medicine. Went to Radcliffe, studied, and then sort of, as was often the case at that time, I think, fell in love, you know, got pregnant, got married. She meets James and gets pregnant and they get married, and she kind of gives up on that career path, and that always sort of haunts her. And that sort of frames her expectations for her daughter, Lydia. She sort of hopes that Lydia will go on and be able to fulfill all those dreams that she didn't get a chance to.
And Lydia's She's one of three children. So there's Nathan, Lydia and Hannah. And she's the middle child as well. She's not the oldest. What is it about Lydia that the two fixate on?
I think partly it's that both of them, both parents very strongly associate Lydia with her mother. So her mother, of course, really self-identifies with her. She looks a lot like her mother. She's got her mother's blue eyes, which is a thing that makes the two of them look even more similar. And so for Marilyn, the mother, I think she really sort of sees herself in her daughter. And that's part of why she's sort of fixated on her. The two older children in the family are quite a bit older than the youngest child, who comes a bit later. And for James, the father, I think that he also really sort of sees his wife in his daughter. He sees sort of her Americanness, her beauty, what he perceives as her comfort in, you know, in the country and the place that they live in that he's never felt. And he sort of sees that in his wife, and he hopes that his daughter will have that too. So I think for both of them, they really look at her almost as a reprise of the mother.
So Nate, the son, he's the oldest of the children. He's just recently got into Harvard. In the time frame of Lydia's disappearance, they're all aware that he's got into Harvard. Marilyn pretty much ignores him. James sees himself in Nate, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I think he obviously dislikes that. He obviously dislikes seeing himself in his son.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That I think, you know, Marilyn is in some ways, she's so focused on Lydia and sort of her dreams for Lydia that Nate doesn't get a lot of attention from her, even as a young child, and certainly not as he gets older and more independent. And like you said, James, I think, sees himself in Nathan just as he sees Marilyn in Lydia. And for him, that's not a positive thing. All the things that he doesn't like about himself, he sees in his son, you know, his son being sort of shy, or his son being sort of more intellectual and less popular, his son sort of looking maybe more like an outsider than he thinks his daughter does because she looks a little bit more white. So all those sorts of things in some ways turn James away from Nate and cause a little bit of friction between them.
And then Hannah, the last child, Hannah, who, as you said, she comes later on, and in fact she's connected with something else, another significant event that happens in the book that we can talk about after.
Yeah, so Hannah's quite a bit younger, yeah.
So Hannah, I mean, I was the youngest of five children. I really felt for Hannah, who is pretty much unobserved. And yet she's possibly the most perceptive of all of the children. She sees what's going on more than anybody, doesn't she?
She does. And I'm glad to hear you say that, because I was also the youngest in my family. I had one much older sister. And so, you know, I remember a little bit of what it's like to be the youngest, that you look up to everybody else and everyone is not necessarily looking back down at you, which can feel a little lonely sometimes, but can also give you a vantage point that I think you get to see a lot more than other people do sometimes as the youngest. And that's very much Hannah's role. She's sort of trying to figure out what's going on in her family, does a lot of hiding under tables or sort of behind furniture and listening in and stealing little trinkets from her family, I think, is a way of trying to understand what's happening with them.
We don't want to give too much away about the story, but if we can, there is, as I said, there's a significant, another disappearance that is significant in the story.
There's a hint of it at the beginning. At the very first chapter, we learn that not only has Lydia disappeared, but that her mother at some point in time also went missing in their same small town. The same police officer actually, you know, was working a decade before and sort of remembers that case and mentions it to the family. So he knows a little bit about the family's history, and that plays into everything that happens. It plays into Hannah's life very specifically, but also sort of into the family dynamic of all of these family members.
You've written the book from, it sort of goes backwards and forwards in time. So obviously there's the current time period of Lydia's disappearance. And then we see James and Marilyn's, the beginning of their relationship. We see the children when they're younger. We see the aftermath. But specifically, we see the story from everybody's perspective. So we see it from all of the family's perspective. Why did you choose to write it in that way?
Well, as I started to get to know these characters in this family, I realized that this was going to be a book that was very much about secrets and about the things that they don't say to each other or that they keep from each other on purpose, or sometimes accidentally. And I knew that because each of these characters had so many things that they were hiding, it was going to be important for the reader to get to hear everybody's perspective. There are a lot of cases in the book where two characters will have a conversation and they both hear very different things happening in the same conversation. And I wanted the reader to be able to hear both sides of that conversation, to hear how James would have heard the conversation and then to hear how his wife Marilyn would have heard the conversation, so that they could understand how these two characters were not understanding each other. In other words, since the characters were misunderstanding each other and keeping so many secrets, I wanted the reader to be able to understand everything and to get all those secrets.
And I think it also means that where I think that sort of different perspectives of the characters comes over most strongly is gradually as the tragedy is unfolding, you know, the family gradually breaks down. And we see that through the eyes of each of the characters. We see the changing of the relationships between all the characters.
Yeah, it's very much a story, I think, about a family processing loss, about how that can sort of break a family apart, but can also maybe pull them back together. I think that's really true in real life, too, that when, you know, a family goes through some kind of trauma, whether someone passes away suddenly or whether there's an illness or just whatever kind of family trauma happens, a lot of times what happens to the family is either they become really fractured because it's so hard to process that loss, it's so hard to deal with it and to know how to go on and to talk about these things, or sometimes it can be something that can pull the family closer together and get them talking about things, you know, it's almost sort of a shock process that causes everyone to bond together. And that was something I was really interested in exploring with this family, how the dynamics would shift as they started to understand each other or misunderstand each other as the secrets started to come out.
I'm J. Courtney Sullivan. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to bring the title in at this point. I said the book's called Everything I Never Told You. And although the focus is on Lydia and Lydia's disappearance, I mean, that title really, I mean, it refers to every character, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons I liked it. I'm so glad you brought it up because I'm actually really bad with titles. And usually when I write a short story, it has no title at the top. And I have to wait for my writer friends or people to suggest titles to me. And so, but I came up with this one on my own. Towards the end of the book, there's a line that the title echoes where Nate thinks about all the things that he would have wanted to tell his sister. And that struck me because it seemed like something that all of the characters might say to each other. There's so much that all the characters keep quiet about, sometimes because it's something that they're ashamed of or afraid of. And then sometimes it's just things that they take for granted that they don't realize that other people are waiting to hear. You know, the cliche of that is like, I love you. You know, lots of people don't say that because they think, oh, it's a given. Of course, you know how I feel about you. But generally, people really like to hear that. And so I liked that title because I think it really spoke to all the characters in the book. Yeah.
I want to talk about why the 1970s. It's set mainly in the main events, the disappearance is taking place in 1977. Now, obviously, it's a story about a mixed family and about fitting in and about difference. But that could, you know, there are people literally as we speak now outside protesting in Ferguson.
Exactly, yeah.
These things never go away. So why the 70s?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, so when I started thinking about the characters and getting to know them and thinking about the issues that they were struggling with, a lot of those issues did seem to be especially poignant in the 70s. So one of them is the issue of race and culture, that they're an interracial family. And of course, there weren't quite as many of those in the 1970s. And at the time that James and Marilyn get married, in fact, interracial marriage is still illegal in some parts of the country. So that was part of it. And partly also the struggles that Marilyn, the mother, faces in sort of wanting to have a career and finding a lot of barriers in her path and in sort of struggling over that. That was sort of a typical thing that I think a lot of women struggled with in the 50s if they were in college in the 50s. But you're right. Those issues are still with us. You can look at the headlines. Like you said, you know, at the moment there are protests going on over race. It's certainly not an issue that we've tidily tied up and moved past at all. Certainly not here in the States. Partway through the writing process, in the very first draft, I was getting really bogged down in this idea that I was writing the 70s and that was historical. And a really well-meaning advisor said, well, why don't you just set it, you know, closer to the present time? Then you don't have to do any research. You'll know all the details. And I thought, okay, that's a good idea. And I tried setting the story in the late 1990s, and it didn't work. The issues certainly were still there, but I think that they were really particularly resonant for this family in the late 1970s because of the time period that that Marilyn would have gone to school, because of the time period in which then she and James would have gotten married. And I think particularly because that was a time where one generation of women were seeing their daughters have lots of opportunities open up to them that they really had missed out on, you know, that their chance really had kind of gone and that they were not going to be able to have those opportunities and they were going to watch their daughters go forward and get opportunities. And I think that must have been a really bittersweet moment for them. So that's how I ended up picking the time period of the 1970s.
It's also the time of, I don't think it's never really explicitly mentioned in the book, apart from, I think, a reference to, general reference to people going off to war and one explicitly racial slur, but it's also the aftermath of the Vietnam War as well, which I thought hangs over the book.
I think you're right. It's also, I mean, I think the Vietnam War, probably more than any other war in the United States, maybe World War II, but caused a lot of, I think, awareness of Asians and then also a lot of discomfort with them too, I think, you know, because a lot of vets came back and were really traumatized by what they had gone through. Unfortunately, I've been a few times that I've been out on the street and men who are vets are out on the street and they're clearly traumatized even, you know, decades later, and they'll shout things at me like, go back to Vietnam. And I just think about how deeply that really scarred the nation's psyche, I think. It also, I think the 1970s is also the middle of the Cold War and a time period where I think, you know, you think about that idea of Cold War. It's a lot of things that aren't being said. It's a lot of secrecy. It's a lot of sort of quietness and the idea that there could be things that we weren't allowed to talk about or that we weren't comfortable talking about. And I think that that fits in with the sort of ethos of this family as well, that there are these things that can harm you if you talk about them.
We're going to talk hopefully about your own experiences and your own family growing up in terms of, you know, researching, for want of a better word, this book.
Yeah.
The family in this book, it's a mixed family. Yours wasn't. Why was it important, do you think, to add that extra layer of difference?
Well, I think that a lot of the stories that we hear about Asian Americans so far in literature tend to be a particular narrative, which is sort of the immigrant family and they don't fit in. And that implies in some ways a cohesiveness to that family. You know, at least they're all sort of understand what each other are going through. And I wanted to fracture this family even more. That makes me sound terribly sadistic, but I think it's one of the things that writers do is they get their characters in really hard spots. So I wanted to even make this family sort of divided among itself, that there were going to be issues that even the father and the mother weren't really understanding each other on. The other part of that, although both of my parents were ethnically Chinese, my husband is white. And so we have a little boy who's part Asian and part white. And so I think about these things a lot. I just sort of think about when you've got two cultures in your background like that, or more than two cultures, just how you kind of integrate all those things into your life and the different sort of ways you can be pooled. Something that I spend a lot of my time thinking about, actually.
There's this misunderstanding throughout their marriage that really only comes out towards the end of the book over the very idea of difference. I mean, James wants to, you know, he just wants to fit in. And there's this thing overhanging them all the time, although Marilyn is not aware that he heard it about what Marilyn's mother says. But Marilyn's idea of difference has always been different. I mean, she loves James because he is different. She's always wanted to be different, to get away from her background and to be as different as possible, hasn't she?
Yeah, I think in some ways Marilyn's got a little bit of a privilege that she maybe doesn't realize, that for her to be different can be a really good thing.
Yeah.
So it's something that she really strives for. You know, it's her way of stepping away from, you know, the sort of traditional role of woman being a housekeeper and just taking care of the children and not having a career. And so for her, you know, she's able as a white woman, I think, to think of being different, standing out as something that's positive. And for James, of course, coming from a somewhat different place, he's already standing out, and his struggle really has always been to overcome that difference or to get people to not see him as different. And because Marilyn's mother has sort of disapproved of the marriage sort of from the very beginning, like you said, she says something at the time that James and Marilyn are getting married, and that remark kind of burrows into both of them. It's like a little thorn that both of them sort of carry around, but they view it in very, very different ways.
There's this one really striking moment where there's an argument and she uses the word kowtow in the argument, which I found it's almost pretty much the only time there's ever any Chinese used in the book.
Yeah, it's such a loaded term, I think, even now, that it implies a lot of things about Asians, I think, that are really embedded in that word that we don't necessarily think of when we use it. But it's, you know, it implies, you know, this kowtowing, this idea of bowing down and obeisance, and it's got a lot of nuance in there that can carry a lot of sort of symbolic weight, and it does for both of them in that conversation. She doesn't think about those associations, but James is kind of hypersensitive to them and immediately immediately that word comes in between them as a sort of a wedge pushing them farther apart. That's often, you know, how we react as humans, right? A lot of times something is really unpleasant. We're like, well, let's just kind of not deal with it and see if maybe it'll go away. And of course, it very seldom works out. And I think especially in terms of race, that happens a lot. It certainly happens here in the States. There's a lot of times when people will say, well, I don't see race. Or we're all equal. And the problem, of course, is that that sort of obliterates a lot of differences that are very real and are very there and allows you to just say, oh, well, I don't see race. I'm racially colorblind. I don't know if Stephen Colbert has as much of a presence over in the UK as he does here. He's got a little running sort of shtick where anytime he talks about a racial story, he'll say something like, I don't see race. And then he'll say, people tell me I'm white because, and then he'll say something funny after that. But, you know, I think that's often how people respond with the best of intentions. What they mean to say is, I don't think those differences matter. But a lot of times, if you just say they don't exist, you end up not talking about things that actually are kind of important.
And the person most likely to say, I don't see race, I don't think difference matters, are obviously the people least affected by those differences.
Exactly. There is sort of a privilege inherent in saying that. And it's so interesting. And as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of talk going on right now about race due to sort of what's going on in Ferguson and elsewhere in the country, the protests that are happening. And, of course, the only people who get to say, I don't see race, are the people who are in the racial minority, right, who get to not think about it. Whereas if you are in the minority, you're pretty much aware of that all the time. There's no way you cannot think about it. There's no way you cannot see it.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Celeste Ng, and we're talking about her book, Everything I Never Told You. And Celeste, I want to move on in the second part of the show to talk about yourself and your own experiences. You also grew up in small town America, didn't you? So let's talk about what that experience was like.
Yeah, I grew up in suburbs of big cities, which is an interesting experience because there's sort of the big city with the big buildings and it's nearby. But where I grew up, it's small and neighborhoody. So I was born in Pittsburgh, which is a city in Pennsylvania. And Pittsburgh is a decent sized city on its own. But the suburb that I grew up in was very blue collar and very predominantly white Christian. My family was one of the very few Asian families in the neighborhood. When I was in elementary school, it was a very small school and only 4 grades in it and probably about 200 kids, but there was one black girl and one Asian girl, and that was me, and everyone else in the school was white. It's an odd experience to have growing up, just where you look different from everyone else and your family stands out from everyone else's family. And then when I got a bit older, I moved to a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, where, again, Cleveland is a pretty decent-sized city. But where I lived, the neighborhood that I grew up in, Shaker Heights, is a little suburb, and it's very neighborhoody, and lots of kids walk to school and things like that. And that suburb was much more racially diverse. It was, I think, something like 55% white, 44% black, and 1% other. But I was part of that other. So there still weren't very many Asians. For the novel, when I decided to set the story in a small town in Ohio, in some ways I was thinking about my own roots and just thinking, where could I put them where this family would feel somewhat isolated, where they would have even less contact with other sort of people of their background than I did growing up? And that's sort of how I ended up making them in small town Ohio.
You say being, like, you know, the only person of Chinese extraction in a school. It sounds like a really stupid question, but did you always consciously feel like you were different?
I don't think it's a stupid question at all, actually, because it's something that I think most people don't experience. So my husband is a tall white man, and he thought he understood what I was talking about, where I'm like, it's weird if you know that you look different than everyone else. But he didn't really understand it until we went to visit family in Hong Kong, and we were on the MTR, which is their subway line, and it's extremely busy. And he all of a sudden looked around and went, oh, no one else here looks like me. And, you know, it's a very disorienting experience. So I don't think it's a silly question at all. I think the best I can explain it is not that I was always aware of being different, but that I was intermittently re-realized or re-remembered that I was different. You know, at home I was with my family and sometimes we had Chinese food and sometimes we had hot dogs and hamburgers and, you know, my dad really liked to go to Wendy's, which is a fast food restaurant we've got here. But then I would go to school and I'd be with my friends and doing things and there would only be particular moments where I would sort of re-remember, oh, my family is really different here. So if we had a substitute teacher, they always stumbled when they got to my last name, which is Ng, spelled N-G. But it's very different from all the other last names, and it's still one that a lot of people aren't familiar with. And so there's this moment where they'd sort of struggle over it, and it's just a little reminder like, oh, you're different, because they pronounce everyone else's name, but yours was confusing. Or there would be times when people, and this still happens to me and to virtually everyone else I know who's an Asian or otherwise in a minority, they'll say, oh, where are you from? Where were you born? And I'd say, well, I was born here in Pittsburgh. And they'd say, oh, but where are you from? And I'm like, well, I'm from here. And then they'd say, well, but where are you really from? And this sort of dialogue that happens, it's like saying, no, 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 like, I know you're different. Tell me where you're from. These little reminders, I think, that you don't in everyday life feel like you don't belong, but then every now and then you remember that other people must see you quite differently. I borrowed some of these bits to put in the novel. There's a moment where Lydia is thinking about the school photograph where, you know, you see the school photograph and there's one head of black hair in the whole classroom. And you go, wait, what's that person doing here? Then you realize that that's you. It's a little bit like that, I think. That's sort of the best explanation I could come up with.
What other elements of the story came out of real life?
Well, I think as a writer, maybe all writers are like this, I'm a little bit of a magpie and I pick up all the little bits that I want and I sort of make them into some new amalgamation. The plot of the story itself isn't really based in real life at all. The very seed of the story of a girl falling into the water came from an anecdote that my husband told me when he was, I think, 8 years old or so. A schoolmate of his pushed his own little sister into a lake. And her parents were nearby, and they pulled her out, and she was fine. But I, for some reason, kept thinking about that, maybe because I'm a terrible swimmer. And I kept thinking, well, what would it have been like for that girl to fall into the water? And what was this brother-sister dynamic like that he would have pushed her into the water? And then what was it going to be like after she had been pulled back out of the water? You know, was she going to hold this against him for the rest of her life? And as I started to think about that girl falling into the water, it changed, of course. Lydia, the daughter in the book, is older. She's 16. But that little seed came from real life. And then it started to take on a life of its own. And I sort of embellished it here and there with little bits that came from real life. So one of them, obviously, is the experience of the family being in an area where there are very few Asians. That was something that I experienced growing up. And I try to draw on that. Another is Marilyn's cookbook. The mother in the family has got a Betty Crocker cookbook that has all these sort of sexist little directions to women written into the recipes. Things like, does anything make you feel, you know, happier about yourself than baking bread? Or, you know, pity the man who's never come home to a pie.
My favorite one was, you have to know how to cook an egg 6 different ways to satisfy your whole family.
That's right. Yeah. You know, it behooves a good wife to know how to make an egg behave in 6 different ways. So those are all real quotes. And the cookbook that I gave the mother in the story is actually my own mother's Betty Crocker cookbook. She got it soon after she emigrated to the United States. And that was the cookbook that she used when I was growing up. That was the cookbook that I learned to cook from when we were baking cookies or, you know, roasting a turkey or whatever. And it wasn't until I was much older that I actually looked at the text around the recipes and saw all of those things, and I was so amused and horrified by them at the same time. And so I wanted to take that cookbook and put it into the novel to give a sense of what the feeling about what women should be doing and what was supposed to be important to them was at that time period. And so that was a little bit that I stole from real life as well. Maybe the other big piece that I took from real life with Marilyn sort of wanting to go into the sciences. My own mother actually is a chemist. She got a PhD and she did research and she taught at the university. But I saw a lot of what it was like for her to be a woman in the sciences and in a field that's even now really still dominated by men. And I wanted to put a little bit of that sense into the book as well. And so Marilyn's sort of feelings about how the men treat her when she's at the university and she's trying to take chemistry classes and they're sort of patronizing her. Or later there's a moment where she's trying to get a job as a lab assistant and the person says, oh, I didn't think you'd want to do that, you know, since you have a husband and children. Those were the similar flavor of things to things that I saw my mother experience. And I wanted to sort of take that and put that into the novel as well.
I want to talk a bit about your parents, because they were both scientists. If I understand correctly, your father worked for NASA at one point.
Yes, he did research for them. That's actually why we moved to Cleveland. There's actually a NASA research facility in Cleveland, and he did work there.
But they were both Chinese immigrants, so they both came to the U.S. So you mentioned that, you know, this was the period of the Cold War in the first part. So what was that experience like for them coming over as scientists to the U.S. during a period of time when obviously, you know, China was a... Did they come from China?
They came from Hong Kong, actually.
They came from Hong Kong. Okay, so Hong Kong obviously was a British protectorate at that time, so they didn't come from communist China then.
Yeah, but still, I mean, I think that there are similarities. So my mother, I mean, it's funny to me, still has a lot of Britishisms in her language because she grew up, you know, when Hong Kong was still a British colony, and then my was born in China and moved there when he was an adolescent. But I think, you know, Hong Kong is a really interesting place because it's got that British heritage, but of course it's also got this Chinese heritage as well. It's got a little bit of a split personality. And both of them came over in the very late 1960s, and they came over as students. And so I think for them, maybe the experience of being a student was a little bit different. I don't know if it made it easier or not, actually. I should ask my mother. But because a lot of the graduate students were coming from different countries, they made friends with a lot of the sort of international students, and they were living in grad student housing. And so their neighbors were also graduate students. And so they made a lot of friends that way. And I think that in some ways helped ease the transition for them into the country. But I also know that they were always, I think, very sensitive to the fact that they were, you know, of Chinese descent and that they might be looked at in a different way. So growing up, when my sister and I were growing up, I think they always wanted us just to be aware that other people might look at us differently, and to be prepared for that, and to keep in mind that what we did, people might look at what we did and then, you know, extrapolate that to other Asians. You know, in other words, we were a place where people would make a stereotype, and so we had to sort of be aware of how we were carrying ourselves. Sometimes they talked to us about it explicitly, and other times it was more implicit, but I do think that they were really aware of that, both from as they, you know, were working their way through student life and then as my sister and I were growing up.
And that sort of pressure to be almost a role model, I mean, that's a big responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a sort of a common feeling often for a lot of minorities, that there's this idea that people are going to decide that either going to form their impressions about your whole group based on you. And it does put a lot of responsibility on you. You know, there's the feeling that in order to succeed, you have to not just do well, you have to do great. You know, you have to be 10 times better, because otherwise people may look askance at you. You know, it's almost as if people are looking for reasons to discount what you do. Certainly not always true. It's not that everyone is doing that, but you are always aware, I think, that there's a possibility that people will make judgments about you.
I'm Ben Goldacre. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This is your first novel. You've written short stories, as you've mentioned, and for various other publications and things. But what was your first novel like?
Well, I guess this is the first real novel I had started writing. Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I always started writing, and so I think I probably wrote what I thought was my first novel at probably about age 7. It was probably all of like maybe 3 pages. And then as I got older, I was 13 or 14, I would write these 80-page stories that didn't have a plot and think that I had written a novel. But this is the first one that I really, you know, wrote since I became serious about writing and had really started publishing stories and really kind of taking the craft seriously. And it took a while. I got a master's degree in creative writing, and I started the novel at the very end of that program, and it took me about 6 years to finish it, working on and off, sometimes more than others, but it was a very long process. It took a lot of drafts, and each draft sort of went through a big change. the story stayed the same throughout all those drafts, but I was really trying to figure out the structure of the novel, how to move back and forth in time, how to make the connections between the parents' generation and the children's generation clear. So it definitely took a lot of revising as I went along the way.
The book's just come out in the beginning of November in the UK, but it's been out... When did it come out in the US? It was sort of the beginning of the summer.
It came out at the very, very end of June, yeah.
How has it been received so far?
It's been really fortunate, and the reception has been really positive, I think. It got reviewed in a lot of places, and the reviewers generally really liked it, and it seems like it's connecting with readers as well, which is really great. So I'm kind of stunned by my good fortune. I don't know how this happened, and periodically I'll ask my husband and say, is it possible that I'm just having a very, very vivid waking dream? And he always says to me, it's possible, but unlikely. But that's kind of how it feels to me. It feels like I must be having a very, very vivid dream.
And what does the Amazon thing mean, do you think? I mean, it was an Amazon Book of the Month, I think, in July, and now it's been chosen as the Book of the Year.
Yeah. I was so stunned when it happened. In fact, they announced it on television. The editor went on to talk about their top 10 books. I only heard about it when someone sent me a message on Twitter. And so I clearly even learned about news about myself on Twitter. And so it feels like a tremendous gift they've given me. Amazon has been their editorial staff, you know, who are not, you know, have nothing to do with Amazon's biz practices. They're just people who love books and want to try and get good books into the hands of readers. And because of that, I think a lot more readers are going to come to the book, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I think one of the hardest things for any writer, and especially new writer, is just getting people to know about your book. And so the fact that they singled out my book to talk about it means a lot to me. I'm really, really grateful for that.
Finally then, so what's next for you? What have you got? Have you got another novel in the works?
I've started another novel. It's been on hold a little bit as I promote this novel, but I'm sort of itching to get back to it. It's, I think, going to be another story about a family, and I'm going to set it this time in a real-life place, which is my hometown of Shaker Heights in Ohio in the United States. And that was a suburb that I moved to when I was about 10, and my parents picked it very carefully because it had a really good school system, and it was known for being racially integrated, that there was a large black population and a large white population, and they were all kind of intermingled, and it was a lovely place to grow up. We have really fond memories of it. It's really, really beautiful. There are trees everywhere. It's very progressive. And the flip side of that, of course, is that it's a community where there's sort of this emphasis on being perfect and perfection. And so one of the examples that I give is that on garbage day, you're not allowed to bring your garbage cans out to the front of the house, to the street corner where usually the garbage trucks come and pick them up. You have to keep all the garbage cans at the back of your house because you don't want the street to look untidy. And the city actually has these very, very tiny garbage trucks that are almost like scooters with big garbage cans on the back, and they go down on your driveway and pick up your garbage in the back and bring it to the garbage truck in front so that there's never garbage in the front of the house and it never looks messy. You know, you have to mow your lawn regularly, and if the grass gets too long, the city will come and mow it, and then they'll issue you a fine because you don't want the city to look, you know, it shouldn't look messy from the front. And there's all kinds of things like that. It's a fascinating place. The more I learn about it, it was a sort of planned community that happened at the turn of the 20th century, and you know, they designed it very carefully with a lot of thought into it. And of course, the idea is that it can be perfect. And so I want to write a story about a family that lives in this area. And there's going to be a mother and daughter who come in from out of town and I think maybe throw some rocks into that perfect, placid surface. And we'll see what happens.
I've been talking to Celeste Ng, and we've been talking about her book, Everything I Never Told You. So, Celeste, thank you so much for talking to me about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm Natalie Haynes. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Ben Okri was born in Nigeria in 1959. He has written numerous novels and won the Booker Prize for The Famished Road. He's also won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize and the Aga Khan Prize, and he was awarded an OBE in 2001. His latest novel is The Age of Magic. Ben, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's a real pleasure talking to you, Neil.
How would you describe this book?
Well, I would honestly say it's a hard book to describe because I'm trying to do so many different things in it. And among the things I'm trying to do is it kind of asks certain questions in a clear, clean story, a shaped story, about suffering and happiness, about the quest for happiness in a world where there's so many problems, where we have, in a time of neurosis, a time of social disturbances, a time of individual despair, whether it is a legitimate thing for people to, ask about Arcadia. And it really ostensibly is about these eight people on a journey, a film journey. So it's very much a media novel as well, searching for Arcadia. And on this journey, they meet people and ask them about their idea of Arcadia and happiness and where it can be found. Then they stop off in Switzerland, and it's there that the real story begins. Because every journey towards Arcadia, towards a kind of quest for happiness, also awakens our inner demons. You can't go in search of something like truth or like beauty or like happiness without awakening demons. It's just simply not possible. So it's about what gets awakened in people and around them while they are on this journey, as it were. And it happens in a kind of valley moment of the narration where I think things are most dangerous, when things appear to be quiet, when people are in nature, when people are at rest. So that's one of the themes. The other of its central themes to me is the exploration of micro moments. The novel generally tends to look at big moments, tends to focus on big events, as if these are the defining events of our lives. But I'm actually more interested in this novel in the micro moments, because I suspect that the real events of our lives happen quietly and almost invisibly, and they just happen in the ordinary passing of time. So I was really, really interested in stretching out time to sort of start to help reveal the dark matter of time itself and of our lives. So it really is about micro moments in which the magic and the darkness, as it were, starts to come out.
You mentioned Arcadia, and that's an idea and a theme that is present in a number of your works. So what does it mean to you? Obviously, in this case, they're travelling to Switzerland, but they're making a programme about a place called Arcadia. But what does the idea mean on a wider level?
Well, Arcadia is a place in Peloponnese, in Greece. It's been made famous by writers like Virgil and Theocritus, and has taken its place in modern literature, in the works of painters and musicians, composers like Beethoven, and even modern novelists and modern playwrights like Tom Stoppard. So Arcadia has a very powerful hold on our imagination, because we think of it both in terms of a kind of a pastoral, but also in terms of a place of rest, a place of peace. It is the most contemporary idea of heaven that we can manage. It is the closest thing that we can get to the idea of heaven and peace in our somewhat atheistic times. It's not for nothing that it has its origin in a pagan world, untouched, as it were, by modern religious notions. So it is uncontaminated. It's not like Eden, which is problematic for many people because of its Christian connotations. Arcadia is freer and purer. And I'm interested in Arcadia because it's, for me, the opposite, the pole to the suffering and the historical nightmare that I write about. I think it is perfectly legitimate and actually quite important for a writer who writes about suffering and pain and historical grievances and despair to also write about the quest for happiness, because you cannot really deal with suffering and with pain without at some point asking questions about happiness. These two poles have to be dealt with, because otherwise you just give one side of the picture of humanity. You just make out that all that the people do is suffer, all that happens to them are the dreadful things of history, when in fact the quest for happiness, I think, is one of the most fundamental quests inside every human being. It's what drives us in our jobs, in our loves, in our change of nations, in our, all the things that drive us through life, also have this quest in a desire for a modest kind of personal and even communal happiness. And Arcadia collects this idea really beautifully.
I mean, just take that idea of the two poles of the sort of suffering and the rest and the happiness a little bit further, because your work has this also these sort of dual ideas of realism, the real world, and the sort of mythical or dream world, sort of dream imagery. Let's talk about why that sort of style, where that sort of idea comes from, why you prefer that sort of writing.
What you're talking about, the dream, the merging of the dream and the real.
Yeah, just in general. I mean, right across your writing. I mean, I'm desperately avoiding the lazy term magic realism, which often gets applied to your work. But this sort of idea of a slightly sort of heightened reality and sort of dreamlike states existing in the same, often in the same realm as the real world. And we'll get onto that. Specifically how that happens in this novel, perhaps, in a while. But I'm talking more generally. And I'm just trying to relate that to this idea of, like you said, you know, if you're going to write about suffering, you should also write about happiness at the same time. Like, those two things have to coexist.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me deal with why I write in that sort of way, in which I sort of hover between the real and the unreal, between the real and the dreamlike, the real and the magical. I think its roots are in my own personal experience, to be honest with you, because I grew up during the Nigerian Civil War. That had a really big effect on me, because I kind of, at a very early age, saw a lot of dead bodies and saw people being killed, and spent a bit of time having to, hide my mother, and I nearly got killed myself. And so from very early on, I found myself asking kind of questions about life and death and what all of it means, and why do people die anyway, and why are people born if they're going to die? So I've been asking myself these questions. You can say that my own personal history has led me to a philosophical journey through life, and these questions have taken me to many, many different places, to many religions, many ideas, many kinds of metaphysics, many kinds of doubts, many kinds of skepticisms, many, many, many ways, many paths, and this has informed my writing. But the other thing is that I also come from this great African tradition whereby the dead are as present as the living. Our ancestors are co-present with us in this world. This is one of those ideas that's probably one of the oldest in me, that my father and my mother, but my father mainly, instilled in us. You grew up in a, I grew up in the middle of Nigeria, and from an early age, Dad always used to say, your grandmother is here. And we used to, he would make libations to his forefathers and to his great-grandmothers. And so there was a sense of a continuity, a sense of their presence in coexisting in the space in which we're living. So I always had this sense of a multitudinous world, of a many, many-dimensioned world of past, present, and future. There are prayers made to the unborn, to those who are coming, who will be coming in the future into our lives in the form of children. They too were just as real. So this sense of time as having dimensions has always been present in me, and I've tried to keep faith with it in my writing. And in The Famished Road, the book for which I'm best known at this point, which has a spirit child as its hero, I had to keep faith with that idea because the spirit child is a living idea in West Africa. It's not a myth. And this is one of the reasons why I partly reject the magical realism label, because I'm dealing with real things, not mythical things. These are real things that people believe. These are real things that people suffer for, that women are anguished about. So when I write about that, I have to address the fact that the dead are as present in the consciousness of a people as the living. And when it gets to something like the Acadia books, coming to the West, traveling throughout the world, I begin to find that actually our lives have a dreamlike content. Some things often, things happen to us in real life, and we just have the feeling that it's like happening to us in a dream. People constantly say that all the time. And I'm fascinated by that sense in which life becomes ambiguous like that. Weird, wonderful things happen to you, and it's like, am I dreaming? Am I awake? Or even when you're dreaming, when you're having a dream, you think to yourself, well, my goodness, is this happening in real life? Am I awake? It's this ambiguity of our experience that fascinates me. And I think this is the real texture of our lives, and this is one of the reasons why I'm constantly flowing between these realms.
It's a story of eight characters on a journey. They're travelling to a bucolic part of Switzerland, an area of mountains and lakes, and they're filmmakers, so they're travelling with a lot of equipment, a lot of luggage, but they're also travelling with emotional baggage, shall we say. Let's talk about what's brought these people together, why they're on this journey, because as it turns out in the book, it's a deeper idea than just the fact that they're there to make a film.
Yes, it is. But when you say deeper, what do you mean before I can explore it further? What struck you as being deeper about it?
Okay, well, more that they're basically, there's somebody manipulating events.
Yes.
To get them all together.
Yes, there's a kind of a big ambiguity in the book as to how they got drawn together in the first place to make this journey. And the sense of this it kind of coagulates around a figure called Malasso. And they don't know if this person is a real person or not. In fact, they don't really know who's brought them together and set them off on this journey. And this figure, Malasso, real or unreal, continues to have a very ambivalent effect on them, a very curious but indefinable effect on them throughout the whole narration itself. And somewhere in the midst of the book, I explore the idea that it is quite possible sometimes that a group of people, by their collective minds, can actually create a kind of a figure or a force or a kind of a being. And it's an idea that's interested me for a long time because I've noticed that on journeys with friends, how sometimes our collective minds, we seem to create something between us that is not anything physical, and things get lost. And things get found, and we find ourselves going to certain places that we didn't plan to go to. I'm just interested in what the collective mind of a people, whether it's a group of people traveling, or a group of people on a board of a company, or even a nation, creates when it concentrates its mind together. I'm very, very interested in kind of moods created by a nation at certain points in their history. So it's a big idea that I sort of try to explore in a very small setting of these eight people on this journey, and their minds begin to leak into one another. And out of this leakage, some possible third force, as it were, is created. Yeah, it's interesting that intrigues me, what the collective minds of people sometimes create.
I'm Tom Barbash, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to talk about how the landscape relates to that as well. You've beautifully evoked the area, the mountains and the lakes of the sort of the village and the area of Switzerland that they go to. And I wonder to what extent, why mountains? Why there? Is there a particular reason for you why it was important to be set in such a location?
Well, we tend to think, it's quite curious, but we do tend to think that, you know, places of mountains and lakes and seas, places of peace, would make us peaceful, and often it is the case. But often, the more peaceful the setting is, the more our own sleeping demons come awake, because at any given point, we have all sorts of stuff, all sorts of unresolved stuff inside us. And in the noise of our lives, and in the noise of our cities, these sleeping demons, I suppose, are not heard because of all the clamor all around us. But when that clamor dies down and there's quietness and stillness, suddenly those things that we're not hearing in our everyday lives, they become louder, they take on form, they take on shape, and they become manifest. And I think it's not by accident that we associate Pan, the god Pan, with mountainside. And the god Pan is very, very important in the myth of Arcadia.
This book is written in very short chapters. Often there's a chapter, a page, sometimes, you know, not more than a paragraph. In fact, the blurb of the book, you know, goes as far as to describe this as a new way of reading. So let's talk about why that style, why it's written in that way.
I've been trying to get to the essence of things in my writing for a long time. It's a very, very difficult journey to embark on as a writer. The essence of things is very hard to distill. It's much easier to ramble on in a piece of writing. It's much easier to write long. It's harder to write short. Short is truer most of the time. The best long books I like feel short for that reason. A book should not be longer than it needs to be. Sometimes you can say in one paragraph of four or five sentences much more than you can say in a chapter of 20 pages, because you're getting to the heart, to the truth, to the simplicity, to the depth of things. And this is a book in which I did a lot of paring, a lot of reduction, a lot of tightening, a lot of cutting away, taking away from over the years. The opening sentence of the book, which is also its opening chapter, is just one sentence long, and it begins like this: some things only become clear much later. And people would read that opening chapter, which is also the opening sentence, they'd read it very quickly and go past it and miss it. But the book is written for people to read slowly, to read between the lines, to read it, to read like poetry, to not rush it. Because I'm trying to get micro moments. I'm trying to slow things down so that we see the thread of our lives, so we see the thread of narration itself. And so I wanted gaps on the page. I wanted the spaces on the page to also be part of the reading itself. I wanted those white spaces on the page. I wanted it to be like painting, where you see the relationship between the solid matter of words on the page and those empty spaces, all those long lines of one-line dialogue. So all of that was part of it. The look of it was part of it. And also it's a retrospective novel, or rather, shall I say, a retroactive novel, which is to say it is written in such a way that the events that you're reading about at any given point only make sense much later on when you either come back to it or reflect on it. It is written in a folded sort of way. So I needed a fragmentary sort of style that also had elements of completeness in what appeared to be the gaps. It's a fruit of the long time I spent writing poems and writing prose poems that I brought to the novel.
Just one final question then to finish off. I mentioned at the beginning in the introduction that you're a writer that's won the Booker Prize, the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, many prizes in fact. And in fact, this book has already won a prize, but that's the Bad Sex in Fiction Award, which, as somebody who loves fiction and does a radio show about books, I think is a ridiculous and a pernicious thing. And I just wanted to ask Ben what your take on it is.
Well, I don't really have very much to say about it. It's my view is that, you know, the writer writes as well as he or she can. I mean, they do the best they can and leave it to the reader and to the world. And I think the passage that has drawn much attention to has been poorly read by the people. I think when you read it, you find it to be a much gentler passage than they make it out to be. I was trying for something really very simple, really, which is to show how it feels in moments of ecstasy. From the inside, we often describe it from the outside, as if it were a mechanical thing only, and not an emotional and even possibly a spiritual thing. And I just wanted to just show for once from the inside what it just might feel like inside. It's a very short passage, and I think his brevity probably drew so much attention to it.
It also strikes me that, I mean, this would go for any piece taken from any of the books that were up for that award and ever have been. But in this case more so, it seems stripped out of context because it's of a piece with the way that the rest of the book is written. It does not seem out of place. And yeah, I think that, you know, just highlights the ridiculousness of taking a passage out of context even further.
Yeah, the only one wants to say is that, the writer should not be discouraged writing about any aspect of the human experience. We really, you know, it's taken us a long time as writers to get to the point of freedom where we can write about our, you know, the political dimensions of our lives, the spiritual dimensions, the sexual dimensions. It really has not happened overnight. These are freedoms that have been won by people being put in prison, being exiled, people have been killed for it. This freedom to write well and to write truthfully about all aspects of the human experience is a very, very invaluable one and should be defended. And no writer should feel afraid to write about any aspect of the human experience.
Amen. So I've been talking to Ben Ockley and we've been talking about his book, The Age of Magic, which is out now from Head of Zeus Books. Ben, thank you so much again for taking the time.
Neil, you have been wonderful to have a conversation with. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.